This is ensemble member John Michael Hill, and you're listening to the Steppenwolf Theater Company podcast.
I'm Associate Artistic Director David New, and I'm here with ensemble member Amy Morton, who is directing Conor McPherson's Dublin Carol. Hey, Ames.
Hi, how are you?
Good, you?
Good.
It's the afternoon of the first performance of Dublin Carol. Mm-hmm. You've been in rehearsal now. You last directed a Conor McPherson play, The We're Here, 8 years ago at Steppenwolf.
Mm-hmm.
Was that the first time that you'd worked on a Conor McPherson play?
Yeah.
And then 2 years ago, you directed a production of Dublin Carol at Trinity Repertory,
right,
where the former Steppenwolf Associate Artistic Director Kurt Columbus is now Artistic Director, and you worked with your old friend and colleague Billy Peterson on that production, mm-hmm. and then you're reunited with him for this production.
Yes.
So how did that project come about out at Trinity?
Kurt had always liked the play, and, you know, he and Billy had kept in touch over the years, and he asked Billy if he wanted to do it, and was thinking about me directing it. And for Bill, it was great because he hadn't been on stage in about 9 years. So, you know, when that happens to an actor, you get a little spooked about going back up on the boards because you don't know if you can memorize anymore, all that jazz. So he wanted to do a play, but not necessarily in his hometown. He just sort of wanted to do it out of the way, sort of under the radar. And so we went to Trinity because it's a smaller theatrical community there, and he doesn't know as many people. I think he felt it was going to be an easier time of it. So we did it there, and then, you know, he did such a great job, and I think he had such a good time that he said, you know, I'm not done with the role if we ever want to do it again. So then I approached Martha and said, he's still interested in doing it, and we thought, well, this is the perfect time then.
Great. So, yeah. I'm sure, too, working with you was provided a level of comfort and security as well, since mm-hmm. you guys have such a long history at
right.
Remains and in Chicago. So reuniting with you probably lent him some level of comfort as well.
Yeah, I think so too. I mean, we have such a long working history that, you know, it's not like we had to get to know each other again. So,
yeah. So Dublin Carol is set in a funeral home.
Mm-hmm.
And the owner of the funeral home is named Noel,
mm-hmm.
spelled Noel.
Mm-hmm.
And the play takes place on Christmas Eve.
Right.
And it's called Dublin Carol.
Uh-huh.
So all of a sudden we sort of know the area that we're in.
Exactly.
Are you a Christmassy person?
No. So to me, this is the perfect Christmas play. Christmas, I think, can be stressful for a lot of people, and I don't think I'm anti-Christmas, but I don't go crazy. I don't do the whole decorating, you know, front of the house, back of the house, whole thing. I don't really do that, and I don't have kids, and I think when you have kids, it's a whole different deal. And, you know, I think this is a direct response to A Christmas Carol in a different way, and I think it's extremely poignant, and Conor McPherson weaves such a great story, and they always start out mysteriously. As people start to talk and as they start to tell stories, you're still not sure why, and it becomes clearer and clearer as the play goes on, but he's a really great mystery writer. I think it's the perfect antidote to A Christmas Carol.
Yeah.
It's my kind of Christmas Carol.
It's interesting because it has some structural similarities and also some direct references, right? There's sort of three visits
mm-hmm.
in terms of how Dublin Carol proceeds.
Mm-hmm.
And there's certainly a sense of, if not ghost, then haunting.
Yes.
That this man is haunted by his past.
Mm-hmm.
Whether that's embodied in his estranged daughter arriving on Christmas Eve, or if it's just on his interior as he negotiates his memory, shares it with this young man who's just started working at the funeral home. And then also really specific kind of clever references when he wakes up at one point and he says, have I missed the bank, right? As
mm-hmm.
Ebenezer
mm-hmm.
Scrooge says, have I missed Christmas?
Yeah. Right.
So witty. It is ultimately a redemptive story, but not in the kind of giddy way that Christmas Carol is. It's a somber redemption, isn't it?
Yeah. I also think it's much more realistic. In my personal life and anybody I know, revelation or redemption, even enormous changes in behavior, these things don't happen overnight. They just don't. And it's always an inch by inch, hill by hill basis. And that's, I think, what I find so attractive about it is that you're left with the possibility of redemption. You're not left with everything is okay now. What you hope is that he's seen a glimmer. But you know that the rest of the job is up to him. Yeah. It's not up to some exterior force or exterior spirit or exterior idea to make his life okay. You know, for him, it's going to be an uphill slog, but that's what happens in life.
Yeah.
And that's why I find it a story that I can relate to much more than some of the others.
Yeah. So redemption, you can actually buy, right?
Yeah.
That you actually
yeah.
believe in.
Mm-hmm.
The interior of these people, as you mentioned, sort of, it reveals itself in kind of really fantastic ways. We learn about them indirectly mm-hmm. through the way that the dialogue unfolds. How do you work with the three actors in the production in terms of, do you do a lot of one-on-one work, or is it just scene work with the two actors involved?
It's basically scene work with the two actors involved. You know, it's a small play. It's not very long, and it's only three people, and they all revolve around this one person. It's a very psychological play, and so the conversations in rehearsal are very much about psychological realism and psychological motivation, which I find I do with most plays that I yeah. direct. You know, you have to deal with a character's history and psychology and pathology and, you know, all the things that go into making a human being, if he or she is a good writer, go into making a fictional character. So there was a lot of talk about the relationship amongst the three of them. How similar are they to relationships in the actor's own life? You're always bringing your own experience to the table. So quite often in rehearsals, you know, you're delving into your own psychology. And, you know, I've always thought that that's what makes a good actor anyway. They're bringing their own experience to the table. They're not trying to pretend they're somebody else. So that was a lot of the discussion, was about familial relationships, alcoholism, you know, all the stuff that make a family.
Make a happy holiday show.
Yeah.
It's Stephen Wolf.
Yeah.
I was reading this interview with Conor McPherson, and he said this, which I thought was fantastic. People have always said that the heart of drama is conflict. I find there's enough conflict in one person to make a whole play. All those swings, the oscillation in the mind, the self-doubt, the uncertainty, the stupid courage, the terrible feelings of inadequacy, that's more than enough.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of applies to Dublin Carol, doesn't it?
It applies to Dublin Carol. It applies to The Weir. I think it probably may also apply to The Seafarer.
Yeah, it does.
He's not plot. That's not what he's particularly interested in, from what I gather,
yeah.
from just working on his stuff. Plot is secondary to what's going on in a character's mind and how they reveal themselves. You know, in Dublin Carol, there's not a whole lot of action. It's three people talking, and it's never more than two people talking at the same time. You never see them all on stage together. The revealing nature of any character always comes in conversation, not in, oh gosh, what just happened in the plot line. That's not the writer that he is. It requires intense listening and patience.
Yeah, and I guess part of the heartbreak involved in that process as an audience member is the fact that the action seems to be people trying to come together or come closer or establish a mutual understanding. But actually what's revealed, if we're listening, is how far apart they are and how different their perception of the situation is. How different what they want is from the other, and what the person is perceiving that they're giving. There's talk about that, especially on the part of John Plunkett, the sort of central character isn't there. The way that others see him and the fact that in his past there's unresolved feeling about that, about the way he's been perceived.
Mm-hmm. he has the reality of his past that when he faces it, I think he is overwhelmed with guilt and remorse. And then he has the fantasy of his past, which usually comes out after he's had a couple. And that fantasy involves him being allowed to shirk responsibility, that it wasn't his fault, it was this person's fault or that person's fault. And, you know, it's very alcoholic behavior. And what I love about the character is that in the moments when he faces up, it's really raw. He's not attempting to cover up. He's not even attempting to apologize because he knows it's gone beyond apology. And there's something extremely beautiful about that. Now, 30 seconds later, he's blaming someone else. But it's that seesaw that's so interesting to watch, yeah. I think. And some of it I find, you know, darkly, really darkly funny. But that's me.
You know, there was another quote in the same interview with Conor McPherson that speaks to what you just said. He said, "The hardest adversary we will ever face in our life is ourselves. That's what everybody is always frightened to look at. You show anybody a photograph of himself and he says, don't show me that. I hate looking at photographs of myself. I don't look like that. You say to someone, you need to go to talk to someone about what's happening to you. They say, I don't need to do that. The hardest thing anyone ever has to do is actually look at himself."
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. I don't like doing it.
No. And it's what John is forced to do in different ways in the play. One, by being confronted with a reunion with his estranged daughter.
Uh-huh.
The other, with this young man who's a new employee at the funeral home, but is in some way the specter of his younger self, right? Mm-hmm. That he sees the behavior of himself in this young man, in the breaking of the relationship with his girlfriend, and the immediate then turn to drink to sort of solve that, provide a kind of peace around that conflict. By the end of the play, that seesaw that you talked about, the conflict between the fantasy past and the reality past, has come into some kind of equilibrium for the moment.
Mm-hmm. And the great thing about the end of the play is you really don't know if he's going to take that forward into a new outlook on life for himself or if he's going to stay stuck, which I find really interesting. I totally agree with that statement. The most terrifying thing a person can do is actually look at themselves. And I think probably that's exactly what this play is about, is a man being forced to look at himself.
Well, thanks for talking.
Hey, no problem.
If you want more information about Dublin Carol, you can visit www.steppenwolf.org.
AT&T is the sponsor of online content at steppenwolf.org.